This is Emily with your Politics in Action report at your local radio station, CJMQ 88.9 FM, bringing you your local, provincial, and federal political news. It is going on 5 years since the Lac Mégantic tragedy, where a Montreal, Maine, and Atlantic railway train carrying thousands of liters of crude oil exploded and destroyed the core of downtown, killing 47 people. The federal government will be funding for the bypass, and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is to consult with mayors to configure the best alternative to pass through Lac Mégantic. An announcement for a solution is expected to be made prior to the tragedy's 5th anniversary. It comes as no surprise that the government would want the railway track to be relocated, given the train wreckage was one of the worst in Canadian history. It is often and sadly the case that governments will alter something, in terms of increasing security, when something tragic occurs. But everything that could have gone wrong on that one summer evening did. And it is the duty of the federal government, as transportation is a federal responsibility, to ensure such an incident does not happen again. Part of what comes with this is ensuring that the residents of Lac Mégantic, who were, and still are to this day, impacted by the disaster, feel safer in their community. It's known as a mechanism of literally voicing demands and societal needs, because if people don't and cannot achieve systematic change, they will attempt to do so by protesting change. The March for Our Lives movement has taken North America by storm, taking place in the US and Washington, D.C., and has trickled down locally to our very own community here in Lennoxville, Quebec. Bishop students had taken part of the March of Our Lives movement last week. Our community, particularly the Bishop's community, is not immune from engaging in political activism. Bishop's has a high, socially rich community. Part of this is attributed to its character as a small community-based university. So it really doesn't take much to get together and engage in a political cause. It is the hope with civil participation that community voices reach the executives. Governments have the power to introduce bills and legislation, and citizens are pleading for something to be done. That is something the government holds responsibility and can't ignore, because as representatives of the people, they need to honor and respect people's needs. The movement in the instance of Montreal was endorsed by a survivor of the 1989 Polytechnic massacre. What makes these movements collectively stronger is the fact that we have survivors of gun violence attending these events, which gives it a stronger meaning. The March for Our Lives movement also comes at a time when the RCMP report was released indicating that Canadians are purchasing arms via the black market. The delivery of the arms is even more secretive, with hiding pieces of the firearms into television sets, gaming consoles, blocks of chocolate, and so on. So they are getting creative because they realize how the government is on high alert to regulate gun ownership. So while there is a movement for gun reform, it is almost like one is resurging behind this movement and is in support of bearing and owning arms. In my perspective, and not to influence anyone in any way, but it is imperative to enact greater gun restrictions because, not to offend anyone, but Americans have proven time and again that they are not responsible enough to bear arms. I do not think it will provide peace of mind having a gun for protection, but rather, keeping the guns out of the hands of those likely to cause harm. Part of what makes this movement more powerful, as I've reiterated in my coverage, is that it is influencing all public areas, and this movement is definitely one to mark this year and in history as the year of the March of Our Lives movement. In federal news, you saw it, I saw it, and I think we both had the same idea, that I have to discuss this story in my broadcast. So Member of Parliament and leader of the Green Party, Elizabeth May, was arrested at a protest denouncing Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline extension in Burnaby, BC last week. Of course, May wasn't alone in her arrest. She was arrested alongside federal NDP MP Kennedy Stewart of Burnaby South Riding. May was charged with civil contempt for blocking the road. May stands as leader of the Environment Party and as an activist for environmental protection and a supporter of Indigenous rights, in particular indigenous land rights. Indigenous tribes particularly affected by Kinder Morgan, and excuse my pronunciation, but the Tsleil Waututh, the Squamish, and the Musqueam First Nations. Kinder Morgan is actually within the first top priority of the Green Party's bold climate action plan, within the objective of protecting coastal waters from potential oil spills. And as such, any oil spills from Kinder Morgan would be difficult to clean up. This story does spark curiosity, but it is not the kind of scandal that would ruin a politician as Elizabeth May. This is especially true because what May was protecting was a good cause, the environment, and this is an issue increasingly relevant given climate change, not to mention taking over indigenous land to construct Kinder Morgan. We know that May is an advocate for the environment, having established the Green Party to reflect these interests at the federal level. There is simply media coverage of this because it is a newsworthy story, not because it is a scandal. It's not uncommon for politicians to engage in political activism, and even getting arrested is part of the process. For example, Bernie Sanders was an active protester in his days and was known for spending time in jail for it. If anything, May was protesting something she directly stands for as leader of the Green Party, and is something to be expected rather than to scrutinize. Unless the electoral system changes to proportional representation, May is the only representative in the House of Commons, and her voice must be allowed to represent all environmental enthusiasts in the country. It's time for another segment of What's in Parliament? This morning, a private member's motion, M166, was addressed to appoint a committee and conduct hearings in order to prepare for the possibility of implementing postal banking systems in Canada. The purpose of this motion is to provide postal banking systems across Canada, which would extend into rural northern communities as well as Indigenous communities. As many of said rural communities already have a post office, all they need is a bank that is attached, as most of these communities don't have a bank. A postal bank is essentially combining the postal service with a bank. The benefits associated with combining these services include giving rural communities accessibility to a bank, increasing revenue for the postal service, as it would be separate from the Bank of Canada and be part of the Canadian postal system, and supply more jobs. This motion was brought forward by NDP Member of Parliament Irene Matheson. Some countries have previously adapted the postal banking systems, according to the NDP, and has demonstrated success. Among examples include New Zealand, France, Switzerland, and Italy. The NDP, as a left socialist party, has always made proposals relative to social security, including greater government expenditures on social services. This motion in particular is definitely a mechanism of providing a reliable poverty reduction strategy and an alternative to supporting a corporate giant like Canada's banking system. In Parliament this afternoon, the second reading of Bill C-71 is to take place in the House of Commons. Bill C-71 is the gun restriction legislation and made its way through its first reading on March 20th. This bill in particular has been moving swiftly through the legislative process, which means it has been generally supported. This goes hand in hand with gun restriction movements taking place in US and in Canada. Greater gun restrictions means that we can permit guns in the hands of fewer people and can see less impact of gun violence. As I mentioned in one of my previous reports, this is one mechanism for the government to show people they are being socially responsible. And that is it for What's in Parliament today. More to come in my next broadcast. Canadian senators had unanimously voted 44-29 in support of the marijuana legislation. Among the opposition to Bill C-45 were 28 Conservative senators and independent sitting Senator Mike Duffy, who is basically a Tory in disguise. While the vote was unanimous, there still remains concerns in regards to legalizing marijuana. I had stated in one of my previous broadcasts that this is ever more so for municipalities that must configure mechanisms of regulating its use in localities and keeping it out of the hands of youth. Another concern is health. I mean, we already have smoking in our society, and marijuana is another smoke product we are introducing in society. According to Health Canada, the effects of smoking marijuana can be detrimental, such as increasing anxiety, while other consequences are unknown and smoking marijuana is not recommended. The next question you're probably going to ask is, so why legalize it? The Liberal government believes it can best control the substance if it is legalized, so it does not get into the hands of minors. This would include not permitting the sale of the substance to minors. Currently, young Canadians are able to access marijuana under unlicensed operations known as dispensaries and compassion clubs, according to Health Canada. As well, the funds acquired in exchange for the substance are sourcing crime organizations, while if it is legalized, it could go into contributing to federal revenue. This bill is passing much faster than anticipated, with reason that there was enough opposition in the Senate to oppose the legislation. The assumption was that the marijuana legislation would float around in the Senate for a good amount of time. So what happens if the bill is knocked down in the Senate? Well, if it was knocked down in the Senate, it goes back to square one, redrafting the legislation and gaining support all through the stages once again. What is relevant to recall is that the Canadian Senate is composed of appointed officials, while the House of Commons, conversely, is made up of democratically elected officials. Given that the House holds greater legitimacy, typically when a bill passes in the House, it will pass in the Senate. The basic reason for this is because members of Parliament are representatives of the people. Therefore, what the representatives of the people propose is likely representative of Canadian citizens' interests, and the Senate often passes legislation in support for this reason. While Bill C-45 is likely to pass within this year, it will likely be a long and delayed process with still much opposition to the bill. Nonetheless, the Liberals currently have a majority in the House of Commons, which gives them leverage to pass any piece of legislation they desire. I will provide updates in the coming weeks on the progress for the marijuana legislation and provide an expected date when the legislation is expected to become law, which should be sometime after Canada Day. American President Donald Trump is putting pressure on its NAFTA partners to formulate a deal by the deadline of May 1st. If no deal is reached by this deadline, Canada and Mexico can expect tariffs to be applied to aluminum and steel, generating higher costs for the aluminum and steel industries. As Canada is the U.S.'s largest trading partner, it does not make a lot of sense to apply tariffs to Canadian aluminum and steel when Canada is the main supplier for these products. As well, the U.S. purchases more from Canada as it does in producing its own aluminum and steel. This tariff exemption does not solely expire for NAFTA partners, but as well for Brazil, Australia, Argentina, South Korea, and the European Union. In other words, Trump is making the U.S. an unreliable trading partner because countries will trade with other countries with the most optimal deal and likely freeze the U.S. out. So far, the U.S. has dropped its initial demands in terms of the auto industry, initially demanding autos to be produced with 50% American content and 85% North American content from its original 62.5% North American content. Already, the majority of autos manufactured are composed of North American content, and increasing it would only render higher prices within the auto manufacturing business because with the application of duties, goods utilized to construct automobiles would be more expensive and would ultimately represent a loss for the American auto manufacturing industries and could mean a loss of jobs because a loss in profit would make it necessary to cut corners, which includes laying off employees. What Trump does not realize is that his actions are directly impacting the people below to whom he is supposed to represent. I think it is all just threats and a way of bullying Canada and Mexico into accepting new terms for NAFTA. With the threat of applying tariffs anytime after May 1st of this year, it is Trump's hope that Canada and or Mexico will crack under the pressure and accept the US's demands. So why is Trump attempting to reform the face of NAFTA when it is already beneficial? One of my family members stated that Trump is just stirring the pot. I mean, what is a celebrity apprentice without drama? That is your Politics in Action report. Thank you for listening. I hope to see you the next time. I am Emily with CJMQ 88.9 FM.